I'd like to speak to you this afternoon about the practical value of the meditative perspective and the meditation practice with respect to three interlocked aspects of law practice: trust, effective communications, and competent representation. The trust theme, of course, plays off Norman's talk this morning. And I agree that it's one of the central issues for practicing lawyers. I want to start off by telling you about a case that I handled many years ago called Rouse against Cameron. Those of you who have read my book know that that's the case I start the book off with. It was a real turning point in my life, and it was a very important case in the history of criminal law generally, and in particular the legal rights of mentally ill people. I was, a second-year associate when I was received a call from the Chief Justice of the D.C. Circuit, David Bazelon, to request me to represent Charles Rouse in the federal district court. Bazelon had just written an important case with the same name, Rouse against Cameron, in which he held that this involuntarily confined person who had been found not guilty by reason of insanity on a misdemeanor charge and had been held at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in the District of Columbia for 4 years, Bazelon held that he had a legal right to be to receive adequate treatment for his mental illness or to be released. It was a startling decision at the time, characteristic of Bazelon's boldness. And the case was being remanded to the district court for a finding on whether he had received adequate treatment or not. And it was remanded to the same judge who had previously rejected his, who was reversed by Bazelon, case sent back, Alexander Holtzoff, an extremely conservative person who had a quite vicious relationship with Bazelon and a tremendous impatience with test litigation and law reform, using the courts for law reform, just the kinds of things that Bazelon was devoted to. It was my first trial, high stakes and very challenging. I went out to St. Elizabeth's Hospital to see Charles Rouse because, like most people who had received a traditional law school education in those days, and to a large extent, sadly, today, I didn't really know much about representing human beings or establishing relationships with clients. I'll reflect on how that has come about. But I went out to see this guy behind five locked doors to get to him. I went through five locked doors. And I had to interview him. He was a man about my age, mid-20s. And he had spent the last 4.5 years at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, essentially playing ping pong and watching television and receiving nothing much by way of treatment. I'll go into this in more detail, but basically I interviewed him like it was the kind of interview that I was accustomed to. What did I know about interviews? You know, there were no courses in interviewing. This isn't a social work school. What I knew about interviewing was putting on a suit when I was a second-year law student and talking to these law firm guys who were passing through. So, you know, I went out there with my suit and my briefcase, and he was wearing a white T-shirt with a sleeve rolled up and a cigarette pack the way they did in the 50s, I guess, in small-town Virginia where he grew up. And we had this conversation about the right to treatment. Had he received any treatment? No, he hadn't. But it was a fairly limited interview. I was in this case because of the right to treatment. There's been talk in our gathering about our practice of law being in a human context. The law practice is about human relationships. I didn't see it that way then. I saw law as being much more about intellectual issues and rules. And of course, Rouse didn't see it that way. I mean, he was rather proud and pleased with the attention that he had gotten, and proud of the fact that his name was affixed to this important case. But our interview was mostly about the right to treatment and what kind of treatment he'd been getting, what we would be able to show, how often he saw a psychiatrist. And when he talked about things that I didn't consider relevant to the right to treatment issue, I tried to move it along. I had limited time. I was working in a big corporate law firm in Washington at the time. Just pleased to have me handle this case, but they also were pleased to have me billing a lot of hours each week. And that was in the back of my mind as I conducted this interview. I did a lot of research on, and I really enjoyed this, on the treatment of the mentally ill. I read a lot of books. This was in the years, I believe, just after Ken Kesey's book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, came out. So all of this fit into a framework of civil liberties deprivation and oppression of helpless people. That was the framework I was holding. And fairly quickly, I had the idea, too, that this case was not only important in itself, which it obviously was, but it really would open a window for developing and building a whole area of law that then didn't exist. If mentally ill people who are involuntarily confined have a right to treatment, do they have a right not to be treated? Do they have a right to choose one treatment or another? Suppose they're confronted, as in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, with the threat of a punitive use of electroshock therapy. These were interesting questions. Can they be used, as was very widespread the practice, that using patients in mental hospitals as experiments with new drugs? Phase one experiments. How do you find people to test drugs on? Look for ones who are behind bars. That was a rule in those days. So I could see how there could be, you know, this could be the beginning of an important series of cases, and an important series of cases that I might get involved in. My corporate practice was not overwhelmingly exciting to me at the time, and I saw a window. The three words public interest law had never been put together at that point. There was not a field of public interest law. I didn't think of this. Oh, this is a new area of public interest law. Those words, that wasn't part of our conceptual framework. I did think of it as following in the steps of the great civil rights innovators, because this was in the years after the civil rights advocacy in federal court had begun to yield important results. We went to trial before Holtzoff. Holtzoff chewed up my expert witnesses and then ruled that he was receiving quite adequate treatment, which was the view of the psychiatrists who were at the hospital in charge of his custody. Shortly after the decision came down, I was having a conversation with him out at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. And I can't remember exactly how it came up, but it was just, he raised the subject of the fact that he had never pleaded, interposed the insanity defense in this misdemeanor charge that he was faced with in the District of Columbia 4 years earlier. He said that his mother and his lawyer had gotten together, and his lawyer had persuaded her that this would be a way of this was a first offense for Charles Rouse. This would be a way for kind of protecting family honor. There'd be no criminal convictions, and that he'd be out of there in a year. So he hadn't been, I went back and I checked out the law on this, and sure enough, you have to make, you know, it's a thing where the defendant himself or herself has to interpose the insanity defense. So there was an interesting argument that he could be released. I was not entirely enthusiastic about filing a new habeas petition in the district court, which would take the pressure off the Court of Appeals to rule on the core issue about the right to treatment, which was the big issue, and instead would take the back door and say, well, there was a defect in his original commitment, he had to be released. So I put in the habeas corpus, my responsibility as a lawyer, and sure enough, the Court of Appeals said, we don't have to reach the question of whether he's receiving adequate treatment. This was a defective incarceration, and therefore he's entitled to be released. He was perfectly delighted. I was very pleased, but you know, I also was disappointed that all this incredible amount of work and my soul's commitment to this case had been set aside by the court. I might add too something about the way I approached this case. I've said something about how I approached him, and something about the way I approached the case. In addition, I should say that I was doing my Canon 7 zealous advocacy duty to the fullest, as I understood it, which meant that in my mind and in the in my actions, I was treating the staff at St. Elizabeth's Hospital as the enemy. It was a very polarized situation. Was there a possibility of settling this case? Well, there might have been, but that wasn't. I just wasn't thinking that way. This is test litigation, and there was an opportunity to have what would be a major gain for hundreds of thousands of people if we won this. The issue came up yesterday morning about the question of mixing emotions into our practice as lawyers. I want to say a word about that. This was a case I was deeply committed to at an emotional level, in part for this guy, because, I mean, to see him wasting his youth with a lot of pretty deteriorated psychotics. This guy, you know, if you talked to him or met him on the street, you would not have said that he's suffering mental illness. That was very upsetting, and I thought that, you know, an opportunity to help create this principle was a big deal. And most of my practice in those days was, it was very easy to keep my emotions out of these cases. And I hadn't quite put those words around it, but it was extremely frustrating to spend my time working on cases I didn't care about. Now, the firm protected me from the highly toxic caseload from which they were all getting rich, namely representing the Tobacco Institute and Philip Morris. I didn't do that, but I was doing stuff like while I was there, they computerized their records, and I had a chance to realize that I had spent a full year of my life, 1,500 hours, representing a farm equipment manufacturer in the Midwest that wanted to acquire a company that made riding garden tractors. And the question was, did that violate the antitrust laws? Because if they hadn't acquired this company, they might have designed their own riding garden tractor and then increased the amount of competition in the market. I spent a year working on that case, traveling around like Willie Loman, interviewing riding garden tractor salesmen in Iowa and Nebraska. That wasn't the greatest winter I ever spent. Now, what I want to talk about is how my representation of Rouse in those days reflected not only my own legal education, but also the norms of the profession. And I want to, like Susan, actually go back to the text. There are four relevant canons of the Code of Professional Responsibility. I'm using the New York version, although the DC version differs in some small particulars. But you know, you might say, well, what does the code have to do anyway with how lawyers behave? Because lawyers don't look at it. But the truth is, it shapes the norms of the profession, and it shapes the norms of legal education. And as I was preparing for this talk and reading this, I looked over it and saw just how deeply these norms shaped my behavior in representing Charles Rouse. So the first thing I looked at was the canon that deals with communication between lawyer and client. Very odd, canon four. This is how it reads. A lawyer should preserve the confidences and secrets of a client. The first ethical consideration under that, these are the kind of overall policy reflections, is a client must feel free to discuss anything with his or her lawyer. Skipping, the lawyer should be fully informed. The exercise of independent professional judgment to separate the relevant and important from the irrelevant and the unimportant is crucial for the lawyer. So what's striking to me about this is, first of all, the canon refers to the duty to preserve confidences and secrets, but it doesn't say anything about the lawyer, about how the lawyer goes about obtaining the confidence of the client. So the client is disposed to reveal his or her secrets to the lawyer. And I think I know some of you who have graduated from law school more recently than I have had some exposure to interviewing practice and training in these things. But you see, the profession, this is the latest version of the code, and they aren't there yet. A client must feel free to discuss everything with his or her lawyer. Well, why must he feel free? And how does he draw the conclusion that he should be free to talk to this person? Here you've got a guy at St. Elizabeth's Hospital who doesn't have a friend in the world. And I come in there with my briefcase and my striped tie and say, I want you to disclose all your secrets to me. You have every reason to trust me because under Canon 4, I can only reveal your confidence under very limited circumstances. It's not that your confidences are all safe with me. They're mostly safe with me most of the time. So this shaped the way I did the interview. As interesting as the canons and the Code of Professional Responsibility is, and it is a very interesting document, it's interesting as much for the gaps as for what it says. The fact that it doesn't address this question of how you make the client feel free to discuss anything with you, you know, particularly where you have a gap in class and education and opportunity, as there was between me and Rouse. Leave aside language problems, leave aside race problems, which didn't exist in that case. How you establish that trusting relationship is extremely important and difficult, and probably more difficult for somebody like me who felt that his clock was running every minute I spent with this guy. So the second canon that I want to briefly describe to you, which I feel helped to shape my interviewing style as a fledgling young lawyer. A lawyer should exercise independent professional judgment on behalf of a client. Well, of course, it goes without saying that the lawyer can only exercise independent professional judgment on the facts that he has. And in that case, I had limited facts, and so my professional judgment was necessarily limited. Of course, I didn't probe, I didn't push for any facts that would have any, that were relevant, that weren't relevant to the question of the right to treatment. That would have been a waste of my time. And so that's why, that's one reason anyway, why I didn't find out about the defects in his original commitment. I never asked him about that. Didn't have anything to do with the right to treatment. So this is interesting. Again, to go to the first, this here at the second ethical consideration, 5-2, that says that the lawyer has to have independent professional judgment. Quickly, it appears, they zero in on one kind of independence, and that is independence of financial conflict. That's really what this canon is about. Financial conflict of interest. After accepting employment, a lawyer carefully should refrain from acquiring a property right or assuming a position that would tend to make his or her judgment less protective of the interests of the client. So again, it's interesting, again, looking at the gaps, what isn't touched. They talk fleetingly about other non-financial interests, but it's a very, an insignificant consideration. And the way they handle that is interesting, too. It says here, and here we're talking about a disciplinary rule, a lawyer shall not accept or continue employment on behalf of a client where there may reason, if the exercise of professional judgment on behalf of the client will be or reasonably may be affected by the lawyer's own financial, business, property, and then it adds, or personal interests, unless, quote, a disinterested lawyer, end quote, would believe that the representation of the client will not be adversely affected thereby. So I didn't know that besides our reasonable person standard in the law, we also have something called the disinterested lawyer standard. Now, what a disinterested lawyer is, I don't know. And whether my kind of mix of commitment to a cause and personal ambition would have made me a non-disinterested lawyer or not, I don't know. I didn't think about it. I didn't think about it because nothing in my education or in the canons of professional responsibility would invite that kind of subtlety of inquiry. And so I didn't ask questions that really went into the question of what this client wanted. The idea of independent judgment all assumes without asking how it happens, that the lawyer knows what the client wants. As we all know, what the client wants is often a very complicated matter. And a lawyer who is really being effective has a serious and difficult job in figuring out what the client wants. I didn't go there. I assumed, of course, that the client wanted to get out, but I didn't really get into the question of whether his real interest was in getting out or how he felt about the right to treatment altogether. I assumed that he wanted to see, as I did, the Court of Appeals decision vindicated, and that he wanted to get out on the grounds that I was primarily interested in. Perhaps I wasn't a disinterested lawyer, but again, the interview process was so truncated. And then we come to the third relevant canon, which is this. Number 6, a lawyer should represent a client competently. The focus of Canon 6, who could argue with that? The focus of Canon 6 is on substantive law. The lawyer shouldn't take on a case in an area where he doesn't have substantive knowledge. It's a good principle. But the narrowness of that definition of competence leaves out, again, what's the gap? For example, interviewing is not considered a competence that the lawyer has a duty to be on top of. It's all about mastery of the particular area of law. And if you don't have the mastery yourself, you should associate another lawyer who does. What about the range of other skills? I mean, the lawyer who only has substantive and procedural mastery is a menace to clients. One of the great innovations at the CUNY Law School 25 years ago was to say, we are going to train people, when they graduate from this law school, they will have the competences they need to practice law. And in the first semester of law school, they were learning how to do an interview. And we were videotaping them doing interviews. But, of course, that's not a competency that the profession has had much interest in, or legal education. One of the things that's interesting about looking at the canons is to see how its requirements and its gaps tracks on the curriculum of law schools. This year, 25 years later, the Carnegie Foundation put together a panel to write a report on legal education. And to my great surprise and pleasure, CUNY Law School emerges as the star of their report. This is the model of how legal education should be moving in thinking more broadly about what competences they're training people for. So as I look back on my representation of Rouse, who got out, I can think of a lot of ways I would have done things differently. I probably would have passed the low standard of Canon 6, competent representation, because I was providing competent representation as that was understood. But in terms of my process, I mean, the essence, the heart of the lawyer-client relationship, establishing trust and an effective and open mode of communication, it's troubling to think back on those times. And there are a lot of things I would have done differently. What I want to stress is the way that the meditative perspective would have helped me to do things differently. Certainly, my experience at CUNY Law School had held up and revealed to me how important and difficult and complicated the process of developing effective communications between a lawyer and a client is. But it's taken a meditative perspective to really help me to see it in its fullest perspective. So take, for example, the question of building confidence and building trust. Here, there is a quality of empathy which is supported by the meditative perspective. That's something that even at CUNY Law School we weren't thinking about so much. And Norman touched on it a little this morning. I very much saw myself in representing this guy in a distanced way, that I was the professional and he was the client whom I was serving. He had been given a raw deal in the legal system and ended up in a mental hospital. I learned about mental health issues because those were his concerns and that was my concern to get him out. There's another sense in which I could have engaged him as a fellow being on this journey in which he was in the mental hospital now, but I might be the one who was in the mental hospital another time, or my loved ones might be. And, you know, in a way, everything about my legal education, my education generally, helped me to shield myself from that basic reality, that basic truth. And the meditative perspective creates a field of awareness in which we can hold that fact, which is deeply true. At the time this case was brought, Alzheimer's disease had never been hadn't been diagnosed. I don't believe the term existed in that. It certainly wasn't the. It was dementia, senility, dementia. There were some of these criteria, but they were much smaller. The cases were much less frequent and much less visible. But in the intervening years, I've seen very close members of my family and dear friends go into these. They go into nursing homes. Sometimes they go into mental hospitals. But the reality that I could have been locked up behind those five doors, and there's a reasonable chance that in my lifetime I or someone very close to me indeed will be locked up under those kind of circumstances, would have given our interaction a different valence. And the meditative perspective, you see, gives you a field of awareness which really invites you to hold that much more complicated reality. Contrast that with the simplicity of the viewpoint of the Code of Professional Responsibility. So in light of that complicated reality, which has at its root empathy and this sense of fellow feeling, that it's possible to imagine that spirit pervading our law practice or our teaching practice or our work on the bench, whatever we do in the legal system, you see, has this opportunity of integrating something very deep that comes out of our experience in meditation with our duties to our clients. The Canon 5, how would I do things differently there? There I have to turn the searchlight right onto myself. And that is my zeal as a public interest advocate. There is an extent to which my representation of him, my failure to establish a trusting, open line of communication with this guy, had to do with the fact that I was seeing him as a means to an end. And much of what public interest lawyers do has that inherent dilemma. I mean particularly public interest lawyers who are doing test litigation and trying to establish principles. We're always looking out for our clients' interests, and we're also looking out for the principles we're trying to establish. The meditative perspective would give us a way to hold that, to say we don't have to make a choice. We don't have to feel that we do one or the other, or that we make choices. One of the virtues of this meditative frame of mind is a capacity to hold paradoxes and to hold conflicting objectives. And to do it in a way which is preserves our ability to act. It avoids the risks of paralysis. And I think I would have been a better counsel if I had been able to recognize my own personal biases that weren't about serving the client's interests, without feeling guilty about them or without beating myself up about them, but just to recognize that I had this personal ambition. Of course, at the time, I denied any personal ambition. Who, me? Qui, moi? I don't think so. But of course, how could I be free from personal ambition? Here, I had never been written up in the New Republic before. I thought that was a big deal at the time. And of course, it didn't affect my judgments at all. And it would be very nice to be able to hold that peace Norman was saying this morning, to recognize the extent to which my motives in this were complicated. To be able to admit that, at least to myself, and still have a kind of loving kindness toward myself, and to forgive myself for those other things, to see them very clearly, not to let them shape my decisions, but to see them clearly and to recognize that that was part of who I was and that was going to be okay. And if I had shown that kind of trust for myself, I think the chance of establishing a trusting relationship with Charles Rouse would have been very great in the face of these enormous odds, I think. The chance of his trusting me was so small given the situation in which we met. But if I had had that kind of trust, I like to think that the way I would bring myself into that gathering and respond to his situation would increase the likelihood of that openness of trust and communication. Well, Canon 6, the question of competence, I think I've already dealt with. The sense of what constitutes competent advocacy is so constricted and so unrealistic, as competence is described in the Code of Professional Responsibility and is taught in most law schools. I mean, most law schools are taught now the way I was taught in the class of 1964, which is to say that lawyer competence is this very narrow range of analytic skills all centered in the head. And the other range of competence, which really makes for what a great lawyer is in any context, is simply excluded completely or is left to clinical courses or professional responsibility courses or professional practice courses, which are marginal in the curriculum, and the people who teach them are marginal on the faculties, which is one reason we have the mess we have today. And lastly, it's probably obvious to go back to Susan's talk yesterday, I would treat my responsibilities as a zealous advocate quite differently. The truth of it is that these were not bad people on the other side. You know, St. Elizabeth's Hospital was then one of the best public mental hospitals in the country. And the doctors who were there were in a radically understaffed situation. They were doing the best they could, and the treating physician for my guy, Rouse, he was all right. I mean, you know, he kept up the records. There are wonderful files on these guys. You know, every time they lost a ping pong game, the nurses would make a note. You know, there's a file this thick. You know, that's the laugh of an ex-nurse. The outcomes wouldn't have been so different in that case. But when I look at another case, the sequel of the Rouse case is I left this law firm a few years later and started the Center for Law and Social Policy in Washington, the first public interest law firm of that era. And we spun off something called the Mental Health Law Project, now called the Bazelon Center for Law and Mental Health. And I handled a very important class action in Alabama in which our claim was that the entire Alabama system was a class action, was denying adequate treatment to all the patients who were confined in it. And we had added in not only the mentally ill people, but also the institutions for the mentally retarded. If mentally ill people have these rights, why don't mentally retarded people have them too? And there, we treated those administrators in that system as if they were redneck Nazis. And they weren't. We could have done much better, and it would have been a more effective process if we had been less self-righteous and less certain of the rightness of our cause and the wrongness of theirs. Now, we got past some of this over time as we got to know them. I don't want to, I'm painting, I suppose, a bit of a caricature. The superintendent of the hospital at that time was a man named Stonewall Beauregard Stickney. And he looked pretty much like Colonel Sanders. So it was, you know, it was easy. He fit into a lot of easy, glib Northern liberal stereotypes, and there was nothing to hold me back from playing that mind game. But here, the meditative perspective would have been helpful. That's thinking of Norman's talk this morning. Non-attachment to the outcome. Do the best work you can do without being attached to the outcome. When I was starting my meditation practice, and one of my friends who had been in it for a long time suggested to me that I ought not to be so attached to outcomes, I said, "What are you talking about? Of course I'm attached to outcomes. What else would I be attached to?" And of course, there are different ways of being attached. You can really be clinging, you know, you can be identified with this outcome, and that becomes all you care about. Or you can hold it much more lightly. And you can think of outcomes, as Norman was suggesting this morning, not what comes down when the court renders its decision, but, you know, what are the outcomes going to be 10 years from now or 20 years from now? And of course, if we had had that kind of spaciousness, we would have gone about this process, I think, in a different way. I've got a new watch here. It's almost impossible to tell the time on it. Apart from that, it's fine. You know how you'd like to glance at your watch and know what time it is? It's impossible. Let's see. Okay. So one of the conclusions I want to leave you with is that the Code of Professional Responsibility is a very good document to take a look at, both to see what it says and to see what it leaves out, and to think about how you can, in your practice or in your life in the law, fill in the gaps in a way which reflects a meditative perspective. Because it will make you healthier and it will make you more effective. The whole question of communications, of course, as I've suggested, if you want to be an effective communicator with a client or with a judge or with a lawyer or with your partners or in a mediation, it's not something that everybody knows. Some people, I'm convinced, are effective, instinctive communicators in this sense. They're very good listeners. They speak with clarity. They speak in a way which invites a positive response, not a kind of a pulling back and an adversarial response. But everyone isn't like that. And it's my theory that people who are like that are encouraged not to go to law school. And if they do wander into law schools, they often are made to feel very odd and very out of it. So that this is a skill. I think people should not be considered as having met Canon 6 competence requirement unless they either have that skill inborn and natural, or it's been taught to them somewhere along the way. If I were rewriting the bar examination, there's a lot of things I would do. One of them would be to insist that somehow or other it tests these other skills, which are urgent. I mean, I don't think these are peripheral skills. These are urgent skills for lawyers to have. Norman ended up, I think, by talking about what it would look like if we were going to bring love and forgiveness into our life in the law. And he suggested that as something that each of us can do at a very personal, small-scale level, and also can bring into our into our lives in law on a larger scale too, in the way we actually present ourselves in official settings. I want to suggest two other ways that I think these ideas can be explored. And in fact, they are both explored in my book, Making Waves and Riding the Currents. One is the idea of wisdom-based advocacy. Wisdom, let me remind you, used to be considered the central virtue of lawyers. Wise counsel. I was working on this book at the library at Bold Hall Law School in Berkeley. And actually, we don't exactly have seasons in California, but there is a season when some trees lose their leaves. So I'd been walking in this entrance outside the law school, and there was over the entrance, in letters this high, something written, but it was behind large trees. And then one day I walked in after a big storm, and the leaves were all down. So I could actually stand back and read these huge letters. Obviously, something meant to be taken seriously. Well, it was a quote of Benjamin Cardozo, the great justice. And I don't remember it all, but at the heart of it was the idea that it was a challenge, and it was inviting the people who passed through this portal to the high enterprise of being a lawyer, and said that one thing we must do is to study the wisdom of the past so that we can order the affairs of mankind with wisdom. There it was. It's only 100 words long, and the word wisdom appeared in this twice. How astonishing. And, a student picking a law school might reasonably say, oh, this is a law school that really values wisdom. Wisdom must be alive here if it's not in the profession generally. So I took a look at the Bold Hall catalog to see if there were any courses touching on this subject, see if the word wisdom appeared in the catalog. And of course it doesn't. And then I checked out the philosophy department. Maybe they have courses that touch on the subject of wisdom. Nope, they didn't. So one of the things I'm trying to do is to reinvigorate the idea of wisdom and to interpose it and to try to bring it back into the law world. I need hardly say with the response is, well, what do you mean by wisdom? You know, how are we going to define that? How do you quantify that? How do you recognize the wise person? Well, in my book, I've suggested that there is two things. One is that we all know how to recognize a wise person. We have wise people that we've met, maybe in our family. Some of them are well-educated, some of them aren't. But they're wise people, and we know it. And in my own experience, I have had the good fortune, which I describe, of spending a good deal of time with the Dalai Lama in a very small setting in Dharamsala. And I identified at the time the quality that he had a number of qualities that I had never seen before. And wisdom was one of them. And I could tell the difference between that quality of wisdom that he had and the qualities of being smart that I saw in my college and law school professors. But no one would mistake those guys, they were almost all guys then, for being wise. And so that's one point. The second thing that I stress in the book is to take our eye off wisdom and identifying wisdom, and to think instead of, the subtitle of the book is Activism and the Practice of Wisdom. Because I suggest in the book that wisdom is something that can be practiced. That each of us can put herself or himself on a wisdom path and commit that to be a central part of their lives, that they are going to commit their lives to becoming wiser people. Not that they are going to approach the Dalai Lama in his level of wisdom, but that that is going to be, they're going to bring that back, even if they have trouble defining what wisdom is, they're going to bring it back into their lives. And that we would be better off individually and as a people if we were to re-energize and reclaim the practice of wisdom. And I've suggested in the book that meditation is a crucial element in the practice of wisdom. Meditation or some functional equivalent. It doesn't have to be what we do here. But something that permits a person to get out of the normal flow of ideas and actions and demands and media noise, which has become the most oppressive dimension of our lives. I mean, it's always been a problem in a culture so devoted to doing and not being. But the media explosion in the last 15 years has been unbelievably oppressive, and to my way of thinking, is simply incompatible with the cultivation of wisdom. You can't do it if your blueberry is calling you at the same time that your cell phone and it's all going on at once, and multitasking becomes a virtue. I don't believe that multitasking is compatible with the cultivation of wisdom. At least we should be opening this conversation. Why is meditation so central? It's because it gives us a structure for this. And it's different from just, you know, on our own saying, well, my gardening is a meditative exercise. Or I run 30 miles a week, and that's my meditative exercise. I don't mean to denigrate those. Those are important and worthwhile. But this practice, where we really are trying to bring some discipline to it and really to open up a larger sense of awareness, a kind of a spaciousness of the mind and heart, has very special potential for the cultivation of wisdom. And it takes a lot of patience, and it takes kind of faithfulness. Faithfulness. I do that Qigong practice pretty much every day. And then I sit for 20 minutes pretty much every day. And I try to do a long, silent retreat pretty much every year. And I think it takes that kind of faithfulness to really bring forward what I consider the transformative potential of meditation. It's very hard to change ourselves once we are functioning as professionals. Change doesn't come easy. I think it takes a faithful practice to make deep change possible. I feel like a little like Norman, that my 25 years of practice, in my case it's only 25, and not with the intensity that Norman had. I mean, I've been kind of, we see where Norman's intense practice over these decades has brought him, and I'm deeply grateful for the fact that he's able to bring me along part of that way. But I would say, well, on one level, nothing's changed. I'm the same as I always was, but in another way, I'm deeply changed. Everything is different, but nothing much has changed. That's a Paul Simon song. That's the refrain. Everything is different, but nothing much has changed. And I think that's it. And I think that's what you can hope to find with meditation. One of the things I kind of tossed into the book right at the end in the epilogue is the idea of what would a law firm look like that was grounded in wisdom. What an interesting idea that is. And I have one paragraph on that, speculating about how the firm would choose its lawyers, how they would live, how they would maintain balance in their lives, how they would try to keep alive in them the full range of vigorous, effective, forceful advocacy and deep compassion and forgiveness. And to my great surprise, I got a very nice review in a magazine called The American Lawyer, which is a very high-end magazine that gets, I think, sold mainly to corporate law firms. And I talked to the editor-in-chief about the book, and it was interesting that the paragraph he had picked out was this paragraph about what a law firm grounded in wisdom would look like. And he said, can you turn that into an article? Well, it was an astonishing, I was so astonished by the question that I've found a lot of excuses not to write it. But actually, this retreat, I think, has given me enough of an impetus. I mean, it's only 1,500 words or 2,000 words or something, so it's not, you know, it's not like writing another book, God forbid. But it is something that I would like to take on. Because, and it was so interesting to me that that's what he picked up. That this guy who is putting out a magazine, which probably it's probably $2,000 to subscribe for a year, that goes to high-end lawyers, that this is what he thinks is something that he wants to see his magazine identified with, and that this is something that he wants to push. I mentioned the other day that these ads for Stanley Kaplan of these people in meditation posture, you can be any kind of lawyer you want to be. Actually, his interest in the wisdom-grounded law firm, in some ways, is to me also a very interesting straw in the wind, and one which, if I live so long, I'll look back on 20 years from now and say, well, you see, that really was something significant, and not just kind of his quirky response to a book that he didn't really quite get. So that's what I want to say. And we're now going to have small group discussions using the format we had yesterday, and we've framed a question for you all to consider, which looks at communication and trust in our lives in law. Thank you.